Okay, let's pick up where we left off in Hebrews chapter 11. It's quite a lengthy chapter. This is the third session we've had on the same chapter because it is so involved that it's so difficult to give each and every one of these examples that God gives us of faith to give it ample time that it deserves. I mean, we're just touching the tip of the iceberg here as these various examples that are given to us. But each one of us is given to us. I think it's very unique in the way it can apply to our own Christian walk and our own particular faith. Look at this verse 30. Okay, this is where we had left off. It says, "By the faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days." Now, here's another thing. Okay, go back to that particular story. Remember that story? Okay, here's the children of Israel that cross over the Jordan River. Okay, they get on the other side and they come up against this massive fortress, this city called Jericho. That let's face it, was actually a city that would be very, very difficult to overrun because it was so well protected with the walls. Okay, but if you remember the story, prior to the Israelites crossing over the Jordan River, they sent a couple of spies into the land, remember? And they're the ones that went into Jericho and they spied everything out in order to come back and give a report so that the army would know the best ways in which to deal with these people on the other side. Well, what happened was that the king got word of the fact that there were some spies from the Israelites in his land. So he sent out soldiers to capture them and kill them. But Rahab was in the city of Jericho. She hid them, remember, up on top of her roof, and she hid them under some flax. And then as a result of that, when the two spies were going to leave, Rahab said to them, "Look, I know that God is with you people. I know he's going to destroy this city. And I am asking you to spare my life and the life of my family." And so the spies turned around and they said, "Okay, we will spare you, but this is what you have to do. You have to let outside your window a rope or a thread. I think it's just a big piece of scarlet cloth outside your window so that we will know your house will not touch your house or our people in your household here." And it says, "If anybody in your household is killed," it says, it's going to be because they are not in that household with the thread or that scarlet cloth hanging out the window. Now, keep a couple things in mind. Rahab was a prostitute. But what's interesting is she acted on her faith. Everybody in Jericho believed in the Israelites' God because they had heard about him for 40 years, what they did to the Egyptians, right? But only Rahab acted upon that. And she was a prostitute. An interesting thing is that when she acted upon that faith, she was saved, her household was saved, and she ended up becoming one of the, in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. I mean, you look at the genealogy of Jesus Christ, and you see the descendants that he comes down from. I mean, he had adulterers, he had prostitutes, he had Moabites, he had all these different people that we would say, man, talk about ancestors, skeletons in your closet. Well, he had them all, right? But God honored this woman's faith because she acted upon it, all right? That's why we have to keep in mind, okay, when it comes to, faith without works is dead. It's not enough just to acknowledge God. But then take a look at what happened to Jericho. First of all, God gives very specific instructions. "I want you to go to have the entire army led by the priest. They have to walk around. Nobody's to say a word. Not one peep out of anybody. They walk around the city of Jericho once." Okay? And I believe that if I'm not mistaken, the priests were blowing the trumpets as they walked around. Then after they walked around once, then they went back to their camp. Second day, they did the same thing. Third day, same thing. And you can imagine these people looking outside, standing up, looking over the wall, wondering, well, this is a heck of a way to fight a war. What's wrong with these people? What are they doing? But look at the faith that it took for these people to do that. God could have brought down those walls just like that the first day around. I mean, there's no question about it, right? Why did he do that? He was exercising their faith. First of all, the guys in the army had to feel a little self-conscious. They had to probably feel a little, what are we doing? We're really looking like a parade of fools here, aren't we?
And they're laughing.
Right? And I'm sure the people on the wall were laughing at them. Maybe the first day they didn't laugh because they thought, "Well, what is this? Some kind of new military strategy?" But then the second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day, by then they were must have been laughing, jeering. Oh, these guys, what is this? Well, the seventh day, right, they march around seven times. And then when they come around the seventh time, the priests give the signal, blowing the trumpets. Everybody gives a shout. Boom, all the walls come down. And it's history. Okay? But God almost like made his army look like fools to the world. But they acted in obedience. They did what he said. They to this day, we, you know, all we can look back and say, hey, doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to what God did there other than to test their faith and to exercise their faith and to push their faith, right? Same thing in our own lives. We've got walls, in a sense, that need to come down. I don't care whether it's in relationships or whether it's in your job or whether it's in whatever situation. In other words, you know, these are situations where I think that God, if we are in tune to him, will, and we exercise our faith in him, will give us the victory. But we've got to continue to exercise faith in terms of praying that he will work things out in his own time, in his own way, and to act accordingly and be in obedience to him. Then he says in that verse 31, it says, by faith Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she had welcomed the spies in peace. Now, I should have read that along with 30 because I just meant comment on it. And then in verse 32 it says, and what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, and of David and Samuel and the prophets. Look at who he's mentioned here. Time will fail me. This is one thing about this chapter. You can't get through it, you know, without, I mean, there's just so many people to mention. He mentions Gideon. Now, Gideon was a man who had little faith. Remember? God appeared to him on a threshing floor, you know, of his father's threshing floor, and he said, hey, I want you to lead the army against the Midianites. And he thought, man, are you sure? Man, I'm the least of the last and the lost as far as my clan is concerned. You know, you better find somebody else. But then he says, okay, I'll do it. But he had his doubts, didn't he? He put out a fleece before the Lord, didn't he? Mm-hmm. And he says, hey, Lord, if this is what you really want me to do, you know, then make this fleece be really dry and the ground all full of dew. And then the Lord did that, right? But then he had his doubts again. He goes, oh, man, maybe that was coincidence. Maybe I just, gosh, Lord. And he said, be patient with me. He says, I'll tell you what, one more time. This time, let the fleece be full of dew and the ground be completely dry. Remember that? And it was. He could wring out that fleece like a wet, soaking wet towel, and the ground around was dry. Okay? So then he acted upon that. So he gets this whole huge army together, I think 22,000 men, if I'm not mistaken. They all come together, and God says, hey, there's too many of you, way too many, man. You got to cut them back. He says, you know, because I'm not going to get the glory here. These guys are going to think they've got the victory because of their own numbers and their own might and their own ingenuity, you know. So God cuts them back by first saying, Gideon says, okay, everybody who's afraid, who's timid, doesn't want to bother with us, go home. Remember how he cut them back? Finally, there were still too many. So then God said, take them down to the river, and all those who kneel down and lap up the water like dogs, they're the ones that you're going to take. And there was 300 of them, remember? So then God gave him the victory. But then even there, Gideon still had some doubts. So God told him, well, I'll tell you what, before the battle, God said, go down to the enemy's camp and listen to what's being said. Remember, he goes down to the enemy's camp, and there's a tent, and some guy had a dream. And he woke up out of the dream, and he's telling his roommate in the tent. And he says, man, I just had a this crazy dream. I dreamt that that Gideon rolled his big loaf of barley down on our camp and destroyed us all. Remember that crazy dream? And then Gideon went back and praised God because, oh, man, this is of God. He's going to give me the victory. But you see, it was little incremental steps at a time, right, that God gave Gideon this faith that grew until he finally got the victory, right? Then he mentioned not just Gideon, he mentions Samson, he mentions Barak. And Barak, if you go back in the book of Judges, Barak was a contemporary of the prophetess Deborah, okay? And God gave him the victory over this general Syria, I believe that's what his name was anyway, who they were oppressing his people for many, many years. And if you remember the situation, Barak was told by Deborah to go against this Saria and his army, but Barak didn't want to go unless Deborah came with him. He says, "Okay, I'll go with you, but the victory will be given the victory will be yours, but the credit will be given to a woman." And remember that situation when Sisera was running and running after being routed from the battle, and then a woman put, you know, a tent peg through his head. I don't want to get into that, but it's just simply he mentions that situation because why? The guy believed, but he had his doubts. He wanted the woman to come with him. Okay? These are given for us our example, right? I mean, I struggle with every darn day this whole concept of faith where, you know, being human, living in this world, when you don't see, you know, there's always that tendency to, you know, especially when your circumstances seem so overwhelming or so against you, it's so easy to lose sight. And so you have some legitimate doubts the way these people did. Gideon did. Barak did. Then he mentions Samson. And you wonder, my God, why does he mention Samson? I mean, look at Samson. Samson, to me, epitomized a person who, to me, had one of the most greatest potentials of anyone in the Bible. I mean, can you stop and think, can you reflect upon the gift Samson was given as far as his strength was concerned, as far as his agility, as far as his speed? I mean, his speed. It said he ran down 300 foxes, tied their tails together, and put torches between their tails, and ran them through the standing grain and throws them. Who can run down 300 foxes? I mean, this guy was, he was just incredible as far as the potential. I mean, he killed 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of a jackass, right? But he was conquered by his flesh. He was conquered by his sin. But he mentions Samson anyway, because why? You look at the end of Samson's life, and what happened in Samson's life? I mean, he gets his eyes gouged out. He becomes a laughingstock of the entire Philistine cities and community, right? And he's day after day pushing this huge grinding wheel around and around and around while people are laughing and throwing things at him and spitting at him and mocking him. This is the end result of his sin. But why did they mention him when he was such a colossal failure for a man who says he has such tremendous potential? Well, it was at the end of his life. You remember? At the very end, when they brought him into this big Philistine theater to make sport of him and to mock his God. And it was there that Samson prayed one last time. The Lord would avenge him for his eyes, and Samson brought the entire house down. He killed over 3,000 Philistines. That's why they mentioned him. They mentioned him why? Because at the end of his life, he exercised that faith. You know, I've often said it's not so much how you start out in your Christian walk, it's how you end up. Okay, now, granted, Samson ended up under the pile, okay, but he exercised that faith one last time. In other words, I hate to say this because I think too many people presume on this. In other words, if you look at, there's only one mention of a deathbed conversion in the Bible. I should say the New Testament, because I just mentioned Samson. But there's only one mention. Who is that? The thief on the cross, right? Now, I think that the God does this specifically to tell us, okay, he mentions a deathbed conversion, but only one, so that nobody needs to despair. Okay? And you can say two if you want to include Samson in the Old Testament, okay? But he only mentions one so that nobody will presume. Yet how many people have this assumption that, well, when I'm old and I'm decrepit and I'm ready to die, then I'll get my life together with God? Well, that's presumption. That's a sin of presumption. And how many people think they're going to repent in the 11th hour and they die at 10:30? Okay? But they mention Samson, I think, for a very specific reason, and that's in spite of the man's failures. To me, he started out with such tremendous potential. I mean, I think back, oh boy, wouldn't you like to have been Samson? I mean, you know, but he was conquered by his flesh, so I mean, he ended up under that heap, but he exercised the faith at the last minute. And then he says here, not just Samson, but he says Jephthah. Now Jephthah, if you remember, Jephthah was an illegitimate child, okay? And he was an outcast by his brothers, all right? And I think it was the Ammonites, if not mistaken, they were the ones who were tormenting the Israelites. And Jephthah had made quite a name for himself at being an outcast. He became a leader of outlaws, and he was just a bad dude. And because he was such a bad dude, and he had a gang of bad men, you know, of just people didn't want to mess with him. The people of Israel came to him and said, "Hey, listen, we'll pay you to go defeat our enemies for us, the Ammonites." And he says, "Okay, well, I'll only do it if you make me leader over you." And you know, they were pretty desperate. Said, "Okay, we will." So Jephthah goes to God and says, "God, if you give me victory over these people, over the Ammonites, I'll sacrifice to you the first thing that comes out of my house." Now, he made a very rash and stupid promise, okay? But he was exercising a faith, right? In other words, he recognized that, hey, as bad as I am and as bad as my men are, I need God's help to defeat these people. So he looked to God in prayer. That took faith. Again, I think it's given to us as an example of, here's a man who had a reputation for being one bad dude. But he recognized that I can't do this without God's help. Again, I think that's mentioned for our benefit as far as faith is concerned, see? But then he was made this stupid, rash vow. And when he could receive the victory over the Ammonites, he came back home. And the first person to come out of his house, it wasn't a servant, and it wasn't any kind of ram or sheep or bull or anything. It was his daughter. And then he was grief-stricken because now he says they have to offer his daughter up. Now, if you read the context, okay, it's very ambiguous. You wonder, well, was this guy so foolish as to sacrifice his own daughter literally up to God? Well, I don't know, because if you read the context of what it was saying there, it looked as though what happened, it says that Jephthah's daughter went up and wept 3 months with her maidservants because of her virginity. So I think what it was that he dedicated the first person out of his life to be dedicated to God and God alone. Okay, I don't think that what happened was that he sacrificed her on an altar. Now, if he did, it really shows how bizarre these people's thinking was. Okay, because it was in the time of Judges when it says everybody did what was right in their own eyes. Okay, but I think what it was he just simply had made this agreement with God out of faith, and then he ended up dedicating his only daughter so that he himself wouldn't have
any
heirs. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's what I think really grieved him, and it grieved his daughter, because she could no longer get married. Okay, but he's mentioned there why? Because in spite of his ignorance, okay, and in spite of his, let's say, his reputation, he still recognizes his faith, his need to put his faith in God. He also mentions David. Now, David, you can mention 100,000 different things about. Okay, no question about that. But David exercised faith in so many different ways, from Goliath, the bear, the lion, you know, all the way up to the end of his life. So, I mean, there's just so many things you can pick and choose from as far as David, and his life is very well known. Okay, then you can put Samuel. Samuel was the last of the judges and the first of the prophets, okay? And if you remember Samuel, I mean, Samuel was just a little boy when his mother dedicated him to, you know, the priesthood. Remember that? So he was when he was just a little kid. I don't know how old he was. He was just, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9. Remember, he was fast asleep, and he hears his voice at night that says, "Samuel." Calls his name, and he goes, gets up, goes to the priest Eli, and says, "That you called me?" He says, "No, I didn't call you." And he goes back to bed, and he says, "Samuel." And Samuel gets up again, goes to the priest, "Did you call me?" "No." And then he did this 3 times, and then Eli recognized, well, it must be the Lord talking. He says, "Next time if you hear that voice called, say, 'Speak, Lord, your servant is listening.'" So he said, "Samuel." And then he said, "Speak, Lord, your servant is listening." And then God, that was the first time God spoke to Samuel. And he basically told Samuel, "Hey, Eli and his kids have had it. I'm going to do them in good." And, you know, Samuel had to tell them what had happened. But it was the beginning of his ministry as a prophet. Okay? And there was so many incidents in his life that he exemplified faith. We don't have time to go into it. Anyway, he says, David, Samuel, and the prophets. Okay, and who, by faith, conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions. I mean, conquered kingdoms. I mean, we've seen this in David, and we've seen it in so many others, and performed acts of righteousness. I mean, we've seen this in so many of the prophets, Jeremiah, Isaiah. I mean, there's so many of them, especially if you think of the acts of righteousness by Elijah and Elisha, raising the dead, things of this nature. Also, he talks about obtained promises and shut the mouths of lions. We know that, that Daniel was very instrumental in that happening. And then he says, and quench the power of fire. Who was known for quenching the power of fire?
Shadrach.
Good. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember that situation? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar had that furnace heated up 7 times hotter. They threw those guys in there bound with ropes, and they were so hot that the guys that threw them in burned up. But the only thing that was burned off Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego was their ropes. And Nebuchadnezzar could see these three guys walking around in this blazing furnace. And he said that there was a fourth person in there who looked like the Son of God, which was the pre-incarnate Christ. And they came out. There wasn't even the smell of smoke on them. Not a hair of their head was singed. Because of what? Because of their faith. But yet at the same time, how did they exercise their faith? They exercised it in a very profound way, just like when Jesus Christ, when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, he said, "Not my will, but thy will be done." That's the same kind of faith that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego exercised. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar was going to throw them into the furnace? They said, "Hey, our God is able to deliver us from this fiery furnace. But if he decides he's not going to do that, we're still not going to submit to your idolatrous demands." Right? So, in other words, they left it in God's hands, knowing full well that God can deliver us, but he, for his own good reasons, might not deliver us. It wasn't like, "Oh, gee, I just don't have the faith to think God would be able to do it." They knew darn well we could do it. They just didn't know if that would be in his will to do it. But nevertheless, they stepped out in faith, right? And I think that was really exemplified them. And then it says in verse 34, "And quench the power of fire, escape the edge of the sword." I mean, David, I think no less than 24 times it's mentioned how he escaped the sword from Saul. And then it mentioned the number of times he escaped the sword from his enemies. He says, "From weaknesses which were made strong," time and time again. You see, look at like David when he was going up against Goliath. Talk about weaknesses made strong. It says, "Became mighty in war and put foreign armies to flight." I mean, there's so many examples in the Old Testament of this having happened. But again, it's putting your faith and your trust in God, not putting your faith and your trust in what? Your tanks and your missiles and your planes and your anti-aircraft gun and all this stuff that we put our faith in today. You know, because God says, "Not by power, not by might, but by my spirit," says the Lord. Then it says in verse 35, "Women receive back their dead by resurrection." What women in the Old Testament receive back their dead?
Zarephath.
Yeah, the widow of Zarephath. Elijah brought back her son when he went to her, and remember he performed a miracle when she only had one piece of bread left and a piece of oil, and he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, make one last biscuit and give me part of it." And she was going to give it to her son, and they were just going to die. Well, he said, "Thus saith the Lord," he said, "the oil will not run dry or the flour won't run dry." So all during that famine period, they had plenty to eat. Okay, but unfortunately, after that miracle, this widow's son died. And then she kind of looked at Elijah and kind of blamed him and said, "Man, have you brought my iniquity upon my head?" And then so Elijah went up and he prayed to God and he laid on the boy, and the boy, came back to life, sneezed 3 times. Well, Elisha did the same thing with the Shunammite woman, brought back her son. And this was all done through faith, right? Women received back their dead by resurrection, and others were tortured, not accepting their release in order that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others were tortured. I mean, you look at, for example, Jeremiah. I mean, he was tortured and tormented. They finally killed him, but before they did that, remember, they threw him into a well that was dried up. It was just mud in the well, and they mistreated him. But then there were so many other examples of people being tortured for their faith in God. especially if you read in some of the apocryphal books, some of the examples there are people who were willing to suffer persecution and torment and even death for their faith in God rather than to capitulate to the demands of, you know, ungodly people. Verse 36, and others experienced mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonment. And we just mentioned Jeremiah. Then verse 37 says, and they were stoned and they were sawed in two. Now in the Old Testament, there's only one person I ever remember being stoned. Did anybody remember who it was? No, I'm not. That's New Testament.
Give us a hint.
Okay, it was Jezebel had him stoned. Okay, this guy named Naboth. Okay, it was Jezebel's husband Ahab. He was a king. Okay, he looked out of the window and he saw Naboth's vineyard. Naboth had this really beautiful, lush vineyard, and Naboth, you know, and so Ahab went down and Ahab said, "Hey, I'm gonna buy you that vineyard from you. And I'll give you some other land." And Naboth said, "Hey, man, this is my inheritance. I can't do this. I'm not gonna sell you this." So Ahab, he goes and he's sulking and pouting, you know, because he couldn't get the land he wanted. And Jezebel said, "Well, what's wrong with you? Why are you so downtrodden and sulking and pouting?" He said, "Well, because Naboth won't sell me his vineyard." And she said, "Are you king or not, man? I'll take care of this dude." And she had some guys slander him and accuse him of wrongdoing, what he never did, and they stoned him to death. Well, you know, he wouldn't let go of his inheritance. But I think when he... You know, they mentioned this, in other words, because he recognized what was really important. In other words, there's a spiritual application to that. Naboth would not give up his inheritance. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with us. We are told, like I mentioned earlier, about when I talked about Esau, see to it that there's no immoral and godly person among you, okay, like Esau, who sold his inheritance for a mess of porridge. And then also it talks about sawed in two. Were stoned and were sawed in two. Anybody you know sawed in two?
Isaiah.
Okay, yeah, it's not mentioned in the Bible at all, but tradition says that Isaiah the prophet was actually put into, you know, a hollowed out log. You know, he sees a big tree with a hollow, you know, it was hollowed out. They put him inside that log, and they just sawed the log in half, along with him with it. I mean, it wasn't no magic trick. You know, it was, that was his...
That was Elijah?
That was Isaiah.
Isaiah.
And it saw it in two, and they were tempted, and they were put to the test with the sword. They were tempted. If you look at Joseph, was a good example of a man who was tempted by Potiphar's wife, and yet he remained faithful and remained true. It says they were put to death with the sword. I guess there was a number of people in the Old Testament who, like Zechariah. Jesus even mentioned him who was slain between an altar and a temple. And he says, put to death with a sword. And they went about in sheepskins and goatskins. I think David did, and some of the prophets did. Obadiah's prophets did. In other words, they were living, you know, basically in abject poverty or on the run or constantly hiding and living in caves, this type of thing. And it says, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated. I mean, when we read all of these things, we recognize that, hey, you know, where is this health, wealth, and prosperity nonsense that people talk about? I mean, this doesn't fit with what we're told about in Scripture. After example, after example, after example, if you're going to live for Christ, I mean, you can see so many examples of people who were persecuted and ridiculed and tortured and tormented and murdered or martyred for their faith. Let's face it, in this century... has seen more martyrs for their faith in Christ than all the other centuries combined. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. And, you know, and to me, I can see the handwriting on the wall. In just a relatively short period of time, we're going to begin to see, you know, that the Christian bashing is going to become more and more of a popular national sport in America. You better believe it. And winding this down, it says, verse 38, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground, and all these, having gained approval through their faith, did not receive what was promised because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they would not be made perfect. And I Titus, basically this is what he's repeating what he has said earlier when he was talking about in that verse 17, where he's talking about where Abraham, when he was tested, offered up his son Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only son of God. In other words, it's talking about all of these people were living by faith, even though they didn't see the fulfillment of the promises. Now, the fulfillment of the promise, of course, was all pointing to Christ, that he would redeem them, that he would be their Savior, that he would rescue them. Okay, well, they held fast to their profession of faith, and of course, now they're recorded, in Scripture as being, examples for us. They've made the God's Hall of Fame. And they've become examples for us. And one thing, just in closing, okay, this has been quite a lengthy chapter. It's the most lengthy chapter in this book of Hebrews. It's 40 verses, okay, and it was just example after example after example after example that was given to us in terms of individuals' faith. But the thing that I found most interesting is that in so many of the examples that is mentioned, you would find that a lot of these heroes had their doubts. A lot of these heroes had moments where they really wavered, where their faith was tested to that point, where they even thought it was just like Abraham, even Abraham himself, and not just Sarah, but Abraham at one time even laughed at how incredulous it would be for him to have a son. You know, but they continue to believe in spite of, their doubts. So I think that it's, if anything, this chapter 11 of Hebrews, it should do something, I think, to just give us a shot in the arm as far as our own faith is concerned. Because I know myself, personally, I just struggle so often with, wondering sometimes, well, where is God in this situation? Is there a remedy, rhyme, or reason for this? Is there a plan behind this? Is there a design for this? You know, in other words, even something like the Bible study. It's been going on for, 25 years, and yet I wonder at times, am I just spinning my wheels? Am I just wasting my time? The only thing that keeps me going is my faith, because I don't see a lot of evidence that it's doing a whole lot of good, right? But I have to continue to just walk by faith. And I think that we all have to do that time. I mean, I've had my doubts. I've had my, my concerns. I've had my wondered at times, if it's all worth it, what's the point to it. But that's what faith is all about, okay? It's the assurance of things hoped for. It's conviction of things not seen, right? That's where our faith is from. Anybody want to have any add or share?